Hi.
Happy Sunday evening. And I'm going to start by playing a song. The song is Josh Groban, Remember. Hi again. all right, so we're here for the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, and we are nearing the end of the book because even this is where we're going, and part of this is glossary. So we are really getting very near the end of this book. And we're starting on page 93 today. And you may remember last week we were having a conversation with a devotee who was confused about Ramana Maharshi's sometime teaching that, I have to turn this down, that the spiritual heart is located 2 fingers to the right of the center, so right here, right? And then apparently also teaching that the heart is just a symbol for the self, and the self cannot be located in the body. And so that's what we were doing last week, as we were talking to a devotee who was confused about this. In fact, I'll read the last question and answer to bring us back into the conversation, and then we'll continue from there. So last week, the last question and answer was, how then shall I understand Sri Bhagavan's statement that the experience of the heart center is at a particular place in the chest? And Ramana Maharshi said, once you accept that from the true and absolute standpoint, the heart, as pure consciousness, is beyond space and time, it will be easy for you to understand the rest in the correct perspective. And one of the things we talked about last week is that sometimes, not just a teacher, but inner wisdom, not a physical teacher, but inner wisdom, and really an awake physical teacher and inner wisdom is the same thing, regardless of the different appearance. One non-appearing, of course, one seeming to be within and the other one seeming to be without. But inner wisdom can meet a particular person where they're at, regardless of how immature that position is, in order to bring them forward, right? And I think we talked about, one of the things we talked about was Eckhart Tolle teaching that there is an inner body, and asking people to focus on the inner body. And then later in the exact same book saying there is no inner body, right? Once the teaching has gone to a more mature point. So now we're going to start with a new question. The devotee says, it is only on that basis that I have put the question about the position of the heart. I am asking about Sri Bhagavan's experience. And then we have a pretty long answer here, so we'll see whether I read the whole answer or whether I stop and comment. Ramana Maharshi says, pure consciousness, wholly unrelated to the physical body and transcending the mind, is a matter of direct experience. Sages know their bodiless, eternal existence, just as a layman knows his bodily existence. But the experience of consciousness can be with bodily awareness as well as without it. In the bodiless experience of pure consciousness, the sage is beyond time and space. And no question about the position of the heart can then at all arise. Since, however, the physical body cannot subsist with life apart from consciousness, bodily awareness has to be sustained by pure consciousness. The former, by its nature, is limited to and can never be coextensive with the latter, which is infinite and eternal. Body consciousness is merely a monad-like miniature reflection of the pure consciousness with which the sage has realized his identity. For him, therefore, body consciousness is only a reflected ray, as it were, of the self. If I always have trouble with this word, I have to look it up to even pronounce it every time, because I only say the word like once a year. I know what it means. It means like light, but I have trouble pronouncing it. Effulgent. Yeah, it doesn't look like effulgent to me. That's why I have trouble with it. Body consciousness is only a reflected way, as it were, of the self-effulgent infinite consciousness, which is himself. It is in this sense alone that the sage is aware of his bodily existence. Since during the bodiless experience of the heart as pure consciousness, the sage is not at all aware of the body, that absolute experience is localized by him within the limits of the physical body by a sort of feeling recollection made while he is with bodily awareness. All right, so let's go back and look at this a little more carefully. So starting at the top, pure consciousness, wholly unrelated to the physical body and transcending the mind, is a matter of direct experience. So what I want to say about that is, you know, of course, everyone who's in Gentle Healing Year 3 now knows that the message in Gentle Healing Year 3 is that you can't actually learn from the words. The only way to realize the truth is to practice. And as you guys probably know, because I've mentioned it a couple of times, since we've opened the retreat house and since we've had a couple of meditation retreats, my own meditation practice has increased. At this point, on a particular day, it will be between 2 and 3 hours. But what's interesting is what's happening since the meditation has increased is that there's this sense that I'm only really doing something meaningful when I'm meditating. It's like, you know, the rest of life is most definitely, you know, continuing to happen. And so I can't meditate all day. I don't even know that I would have the stamina yet to meditate all day. I haven't tried. But I can't because, you know, work still calls me out and family life still calls me out. And I need to go and give attention to these things. But there's this feeling that the only time that I'm really doing anything meaningful is when I'm in meditation. Everything else is just kind of like treading water. And then when I'm in meditation, I'm swimming again and I'm going somewhere. And it's the swimming that's really important. Also, this is kind of a funny statement. I am both aware and not aware of the fact that every single day that I meditate, there's progress. And the reason I say I am both aware and I'm not aware is because the awareness is on an intuitive sense. The awareness of progress is on an intuitive sense. And if someone was to say to me, well, what progress are you making? I could never, ever answer the question. So that's what I mean by not aware, right? Both aware and not aware. So the reason this comes up, again, if we look at this first sentence from Ramana Maharshi, pure consciousness, wholly unrelated to the physical body and transcending the mind, is a matter of direct experience. It's that knowing that is creating this sense that I'm only doing something meaningful when I'm in meditation, right? Knowing that truth can only be realized by me as a direct experience, right? It can't be realized through the words of a sage, although those words motivate us to practice. It can't be realized through watching videos of other masters or other teachers. It can only be realized by me. Closing my eyes, and I'm going to call it digging within. It has to be a direct experience. I remember we read a question and answer not too long ago where a devotee asked Ramana Maharshi, he was talking about meditation, and the devotee asked Ramana Maharshi, oh, this actually happened at a retreat. It wasn't on this audio. People are going, huh? This happened at the self-inquiry retreat. Ramana Maharshi, a devotee asked Ramana Maharshi, well, what happens when you stop the self-inquiry, when you stop the meditation, when you open your eyes? And Ramana Maharshi says, well, the entire world, you know, comes back. And basically that's just as it is. That's just is as it is. And of course he was talking about for a person who is practicing, not for an enlightened sage. And again, that is most definitely what happens. You know, I go into the meditation and I practice self-inquiry. And there's this digging. And then time is up. And I open my eyes and, you know, not immediately, but, you know, within a certain amount of time, everything is back again. And I find myself looking forward to tomorrow when I can go back into a meditation again, when I can go back into a meaningful activity again. So, pure consciousness, wholly unrelated to the physical body, and transcending the mind is a matter of direct experience. Sages know their bodiless, eternal existence, just as the layman knows his bodily existence. So another thing that's happening as I'm meditating more is that the discernment of what's real and what's not real is becoming very sharp, very crisp, very clear. And so even though things like the bodily existence is experienced, the Regina personality is experienced, the mom role is experienced, the president minister role is experienced, the partner to Ron role is experienced. It seems story-like. It seems story-like rather than real. It's almost like I'm telling a secret now. Jasmine was home for this weekend, and I was looking at her in the way that I've looked at her before. You know, when I've looked at this face and thought that this face is just the most beautiful face in the world, and she's the most beloved person in the world to me. And I still think the face is quite cute. But I could feel the story. The reason I'm whispering is I wouldn't want her or Ron to hear this. I could feel the story. I could feel the, but it didn't have the weight of reality. The reality that is experienced during meditation. It's like, this, I don't want to influence you with Jesus. So I'm going to turn him around, but then I got Shiva on the back. So either way, I'm influencing you, I guess. But this is very hard. If I threw this on my computer, I'd break my computer, right? This is stone. This is reality. And this is everything that happens outside of it, this Kleenex. You see the difference? I mean, the Kleenex is still here. The Kleenex is still experienced, but it doesn't have the same weight as the reality. That's what it feels like. When used to, this is what the story felt like, and there wasn't even a Kleenex for reality. Reality wasn't even that much. It was just this, right? Taking up the whole screen, right? That's all there was. And now, again, this is still experience, but it feels more like the Kleenex, where the reality, you know, feels like the stone. So let's return to what Ramana Maharshi is saying after I explain that. Sages know their bodiless eternal existence, just as a layman knows his bodily existence. So to a layman, you know, the bodily existence is the stone, right? The stone. And to a sage, reality is the stone. You see? The sage knows his bodily existence the same as the unenlightened man. I'm sorry, the sage knows his bodiless existence the same that an ordinary man knows his bodily existence as solid, as a stone, as reality. Sages know their bodiless eternal existence just as the layman knows his bodily existence. But the experience of consciousness can be with bodily awareness as well as without it, right? Like the Kleenex, you know, the Kleenex, the story, you know, it can be experienced, but it's not, it doesn't have the weight of the stone. It doesn't have the meaning of the stone. But the experience of consciousness can be with bodily awareness as well as without it. In the bodiless experience of pure consciousness, the sage is beyond time and space. And no question about the position of the heart can then at all arise. And no question can arise. No confusion can arise. No concern can arise. There's just this awareness. For me, you know, because I'm not awake yet, at the point that I have gotten to thus far and expect to still go beyond, is there's this awareness where, I'll just pick up, what can I pick up? I need something to pick up. My phone will do. There's this awareness. This, let's call this the mind. My phone is the mind. There's this awareness that the mind is out here. And I am here. And I don't even have to pay attention to the mind. Right? And if I don't pay attention to the mind and it begins to drift back into view, all I have to do is remember that this is just the mind and it disappears again. That's very different than the perspective that a lot of people have, where they don't know the difference between me and the mind. You know, like the mind is somewhere here, you know, kind of, you know, it's touching, it's right here, it's inside, you know. So there's this awareness that I don't have to be involved in the mind, and of course not in the world, which the world is out in front of the mind. Here's the world. It's out here. There's the mind. And here I am back here, right? So I don't have to be aware of the mind, which means, of course, I won't be aware of the world, because you're only aware of the world when you're aware of the mind. So I don't have to be aware of the mind. And again, if the mind starts to come back in, I just have to remember that it's just mind, and it will go away again. And I think that's probably well describes the awareness that I have reached at this point. It's a maturing process. It's an awareness that the mind is in front of me, and I don't have to be aware of mind. I don't have to give it any attention, even though sometimes the attention drifts there, and then I just remember where it is, and it goes away again. So there's just this awareness for me that I don't have to be aware of mind, that it's not me, and I don't have to pay any attention to it. So again, what Ramana Maharshi is saying is, in the bodiless experience of pure consciousness, the sage is beyond time and space, and no question about the position of the heart can then at all arise. So if I'm in meditation and I've reached this point now where the mind is not in my awareness, I'm not going to say the mind is silent, although that may be true, but I'll tell you why. At an earlier stage in my meditation, whenever the mind got quiet, or it appeared to get quiet, and I brought my attention to the fact that the mind was quiet, it brought the mind right back again. Because I brought my attention, I let my attention go to the mind. So I don't want to think about the mind at all. I don't want to say the mind is quiet. That brings my attention to the mind. I just want to say I don't have to be aware of the mind. So if I'm in meditation, I'm in that state of being aware that I don't have to be aware of the mind, that I can be aware without the mind. And a question begins to arise, any question at all, certainly a question like, where is the spiritual heart, would never arise. But since that's the topic, let's just pretend for a moment that that arises. If that question began to arise, if that was a curiosity in my mind, and if I'm in meditation, aware that I do not have to be aware of mind, aware that I can be aware without mind, and a question began to arise, where is that spiritual heart? I would look right at it and say, that's just mind. I would turn my attention away from it, because it's completely unnecessary and has no purpose or meaning. And any other question that would arise, if a question would arise like, and this question is much more likely to arise for me, like, oh, is this awareness watching awareness, right? Is this it? That's just mind. That's just mind. Because if I allow my attention to go into the question, what I'm really doing is I'm allowing my attention to go into the mind. And this again is what the step one quotes are teaching. In fact, several of the step one quotes that people have seen, it's even talked very specifically about questions, about not asking questions. And at the level where you still think you are learning in a mental way, the same way you learned in history class and math class, where you raised your hand and you asked a question, that can seem extremely unfair. It can feel very unloving. You know, God doesn't even want me to ask questions. God is a really, narcissistic teacher. But when you understand that what's happening when you ask a question is that your attention is going into mind, and that you don't have to be aware of mind. And in fact, the state that you want to practice right now is the state of not being aware of mind, of just being aware of self. But then you understand that the questions are a trick. They're just to get you thinking again. So it doesn't matter what question would arise, and sometimes things arise that do seem important to what I have to do, like, you know, maybe I have to put something on the website today, and this idea will come up about, oh, here's a way to present that on the website. During meditation, I just see that as another temptation to inner mind. And what I say to that is, if this is important, it will come back later. Right now I'm meditating. In other words, during meditation, I don't give my attention to any thought except for thoughts of inquiry, like, what am I? What sees this? Right, those types of questions. Where am I is one that arises a lot. Where am I? You know, obviously, that's just mind, right? That's really a thought. But there are certain types of thoughts I find that take me away from mind. And there are certain types of thoughts that are trying to draw me into mind, right? And so I've learned to discern the difference easily without any thought, praise the Lord. And so I can know immediately whether that thought is a thought that's taking me away from mind, such as what am I, where am I, who sees this, that's just mind, that's not important, right? And the thoughts pulling me into mind, like, oh, is this awareness watching awareness? Isn't that funny? Because you would think that if you're practicing awareness watching awareness, a question like, oh, is this awareness watching awareness, wouldn't be a temptation. But if you pay attention, you can feel that it is. You can feel that it's pulling you back into thinking, right? Even if you start thinking about everything that Ramana Maharshi has said, or Nisargadatta has said, or Michael Langford has said, or Regina Don Acres has said, you're still right back into thinking. So again, Ramana Maharshi says, in the bodiless experience of pure consciousness, the sage is beyond time and space, and no question about the position of the heart can then at all arise. And like I said, in my state, you know, I'm not that far where they can't arise, but I am that far where I realize I don't have to give them attention in a very genuine way. And I can just ignore thoughts that arise. Since, however, the physical body cannot subsist apart from consciousness, bodily awareness has to be sustained by pure consciousness. The former, being bodily awareness, by its nature, is limited to and can never be coextensive with the latter consciousness, which is infinite and eternal. So let's look up coextensive. I think I'm guessing what that means, but rather than guess, let's just look it up. Okay, yeah, it means what I thought it meant. The body cannot correspond exactly in extent pure consciousness. Right? So, although the body is sustained by pure consciousness, and the body certainly would not have any appearance at all, not even its flimsy appearance, if there wasn't consciousness. The body is nothing compared to consciousness. Right? It's nothing compared to consciousness. Again, the reality is like a rock. And the body is like a flimsy Kleenex. They just don't have the same weight. If you put them on a scale, in the sage's opinion, and you know, if you put reality on this scale, it's going to go like this, right? It's going to drop because it's the heavy one, and this is going to go up. So even though the body is sustained by consciousness, it just doesn't have the meaning, the weight, the value, the importance, the you know, anything, you keep naming stuff, the treasure, the heart, the consciousness has. So since, however, the physical body cannot subsist apart from consciousness, bodily awareness has to be sustained by pure consciousness. The former, however, bodily awareness, by its nature, is limited to and can never be coextensive with the latter, pure consciousness, which is infinite and eternal. So again, the sage clearly has that distinction that I've talked about that's arising for me, that distinction that's very, very aware of the difference between the real and the unreal, the difference between the meaningful and the not meaningful, the flimsy, the difference between the valuable and the not valuable, the temporary. There's no confusion. Body consciousness is merely a monad-like. Let's go ahead and look this word up too. Okay, my dictionary says, what the heck? So let's go back to monad. Monad is a single unit, a number one, a single-celled organism, or a single cell. Yeah, it looks like maybe monad-like, maybe would mean, you know, like small part of a whole. You know, like your body is made up of cells, but how aware are you of these cells? Right. I mean, the cell is definitely a part of the body, but you know, how meaningful, how important are they to you? How much time do you spend thinking about your cells during the day? Right. So maybe that's what monad-like means. I can try a better dictionary. Let me find a better dictionary, since it wasn't in my quick reference guide. Just to make sure we get the right meaning here. We don't want to, it was monad-like meaning. Of course, that might not even be a word. Might be, you know, because sometimes I know I make up words. Here we go. Here's monad-like. Oh my gosh. I have to know science though, which I don't. Here, I'll read it to you when it rises up. Monad-like, resembling a flagellant protozoan. Flagellant, not farting, I don't think. Is that what flagellant is? Let me share the screen and show this. Maybe some of you guys are smarter than me, and you can tell me what the heck this is, so that we can get the real meaning here. So, resembling or designating a flagellate protozoan. Does anybody know what that is? We'll ask. Whoops. Flagellate protozoan. What's that? No matches. I probably spelt it wrong because I can't look at both at the same time. Is Jay coming over to help us out? Does he know this stuff?
The flagellates are little hairs that come out of the protozoa that make it move around in locomotion. Like it moves those little flagellates or hairs to spin around and move through water.
Okay, well, that just doesn't tell me a dang thing, but thank you, Jay. Yeah, that doesn't tell me at all why Ramana Maharshi would say this. I suppose it's just kind of over my head, the whole science of it. To me, it means unimportant. It's unimportant to me. Body consciousness is merely a monad-like miniature reflection of the pure consciousness. Just, you know, tiny, tiny, tiny is what I'm hearing. That's the only thing I can hear. Tiny, 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 tiny. You know, unimportant. Yeah, the sage's vocabulary is impressive at times. Yeah, I think Ramana Maharshi was actually probably pretty smart. his brain, his, you know, was probably pretty smart. But, you know, one of the things that I have noticed, I'll just put it in my own words, it's better to go from my own experience. So one of the things that I have noticed during meditation is that the idea of a self, of me, of a Regina, the idea of a self is nothing but a very tiny, 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 tight focal point on sensations, the sensations of the body. If I open my eyes, a perception, the perception of the body, and the thoughts. That's where the me comes from. If I really focus attention on that, and I don't let my attention move from that, I just stay staring at it, staring at it, staring at it, the sensations of the body, the perception of the body, and the thoughts that enter this mind, I can believe I'm a me. But it's a very tiny bundle, and I have to be very, very focused on it to believe it's me. So maybe he's trying to say something like that, right? Body consciousness is merely a monad-like miniature reflection of the pure consciousness, right? I have to go. You know, it's like focusing on a grain of rice and not noticing the rest of the dish, the rest of the meal that's around it. You know, you're just focusing on a grain of rice. And then you're saying, that's me. That's me, that's me. And you have to ignore so much to believe in the me, right? So maybe this is really what he's trying to say with these very smart words that I can't quite grasp. Body consciousness is merely a monad-like miniature reflection of the pure consciousness with which the sage has realized his identity. So the sage is no longer caught up in that little tiny bundle of sensations, one single perception, and the thoughts. That tiny, tiny focal point. It really is very small. You have no idea how small it is. That tiny, tiny focal point. He's not caught up with that tiny, tiny focal point as me. Right? He has released that, and he has leaned back into this pure infinite consciousness that has no borders, has no edges, right? And he now identifies with that, right? I am that, as Nisargadatta would say. So body consciousness is merely a monad-like miniature reflection of the pure consciousness with which the sage has realized his identity. For him, therefore, body consciousness is only a reflected ray, as it were, of the self-effulgent, which would be very bright, bright light like the sun, very bright, 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 of the self-effulgent infinite consciousness, which is himself. And what's interesting about this particular sentence is he doesn't say that body consciousness is only a ray of the self-effulgent. He says body consciousness is only a reflected ray. Like he doesn't even give it, that much meaning as of being a ray of the sun. It's not a ray of the sun. It's like, here's the sun, which is the self. This is what I am. And then there are rays that shoot off of me, hit something else and bounce off, like hit the moon and bounce off, it appearing as moonlight, and the body consciousness is somewhere over there. Like it's very, very weak, very, very different from what I really am. It's an extremely poor idea of the self. Okay, Ron has typed in something that clarifies a monad acts as a container that abstracts away those quirks and the computations and let us focus more on what we want to do with the contained values. Well, that may clarify for some people. Ron, if you want to take the mic and share in layman's terms, I'd be happy to hear. But it doesn't clarify for me because I just do not have a scientific mind. I'll leave that up to you if you want to share. I'll wait a second. I'll have a drink. Yeah, but I'll read it again since it might clarify for some people. A monad acts as a container that abstracts away those quirks in the computations and lets us focus more on what we want to do with the contained values. And he says, can't talk. So there we go. I read that. Maybe some of y'all that really clarified. For me, I'd have to spend a whole nother hour looking up those words. And so, body consciousness is merely a monad-like miniature reflection of the pure consciousness with which the sage has realized his identity. For him, therefore, body consciousness is only a reflected ray, as it were, of the self-effulgent infinite consciousness which is himself. It is in this sense alone that the body is aware of his bodily existence. And again, the example I'm going to use is that it's like a, you know, very, very thin, thin Kleenex, you know. But it just doesn't have any meaning at all. Not any real meaning at all. It's a thin, veil-like, dream-like, story-like, unreal-like experience. Since during the bodiless experience of the heart as pure consciousness, the sage is not at all aware of the body, that absolute experience is localized by him within the limits of the physical body by a sort of feeling recollection made while he is with bodily awareness. Okay, so what Ramana Maharshi now seems to be saying, again, he's going back to this person who wants to know, why do you say that the self or the heart is located within the body in a certain position? And what he's saying is, you know, when in, I'm going to call it samadhi, there's no awareness of the body at all. But when the sage brings some attention back to bodily awareness, you know, there's just this feeling. And that feeling he is calling the heart within the body that is there as a constant reminder, if you want to use the word reminder, it's probably not necessary, a constant awareness, I think I'll use that word instead, of the self, of the truth. And there's never any confusion, even when there is some bodily awareness, there's never any confusion that this is what I am. And again, he's just answering questions here. You know, he's talking to a man who's extremely concerned about why sometimes there's a teaching that the heart, spiritual heart, the self is within. And he's answering. I actually don't think his answer, this last paragraph, is the most important part of what we've read. Again, the last paragraph saying, since during the bodiless experience of the heart as pure consciousness, the sage is not at all aware of the body. That absolute experience is localized by him within the limits of the physical body as a sort of feeling recollection made while he is within bodily awareness. I don't think that's too important. In fact, I think if we think too much about that, we're going to miss the point. I think that what's most important about this is that if we take the time to go into self-inquiry meditation, and we ignore the mind, and we look for the self, for self-awareness, I'm going to call it, we look for self-awareness, and we abide to the best of our ability in and as self-awareness, and we continually seek to go deeper, to become more established, and that this becomes what's important to us, that everything else that used to be important will still be there, but it won't have the same importance it used to have. I think that's what's important for us to realize out of this, that there's a shifting of what's valuable in our own perception. And it's a very real shift. You know, assuming you're hungry for the truth, right? If you're not hungry for the truth, my guess is you're not going to spend 2 to 3 hours in meditation, or 3 to 4 hours, or 4 to 5 hours, or whatever, right? I mean, why would you? Okay, Ron says, this is better. Monad means that which is one, has no parts, and is therefore indivisible. Oh, really? The body consciousness is merely a monad-like, sort of maybe saying it appears to be one, miniature reflection of the pure consciousness. Did you want to say something, Don?
Yep, talk about it.
Can I speak real quick?
Oh, yeah.
The monad was a term that Bailey, Blavatsky, and Besant used in that 1898 metaphysics movement, like those blue books with the white lettering. They were all about the monad, which is the definition that you just said. That which is indivisible, blah, blah, blah. Remember that's from those
books. That's what I read from Ron. So what I'm still confused on, nor am I going to spend any more time on it, is exactly why Ramana Maharshi is referring to the body as monad-like. I mean, that's not clear to me at this moment. I don't know if that's clear to anybody else. Maybe it's just that, it appears to be like one thing. I don't know exactly. But I'm going to do with that what I do in meditation, is I'm just going to perceive it as a distraction. I'm going to let it go. I don't think I need to understand that. I think it's okay that I don't understand that. I think what I do understand is that the body does not have the sense of reality that the truth has. To one who has awakened to truth, certainly, but even to those of us who put our effort into abiding and finding an abiding into our furthest back state of self-awareness for as long as possible every day. Right? I think that's what's important. So, moving on, the next question. The devotee says, for men like me, who have neither the direct experience of the heart nor the consequent recollection. Because remember, Ramana Maharshi said, when there is body awareness, there's this recollection that is localized in the body. For men like me, who have neither the direct experience of the heart nor the consequent recollection, the matter seems to be somewhat difficult to grasp. About the position of the heart itself, perhaps, we must depend on some sort of guesswork. Ramana Maharshi says, if the determination of the position of the heart is to depend on guesswork, even in the case of the layman, the question is surely not worth much consideration. No, it is not on guesswork that you have to depend. It is on unerring intuition. The devotee says, for whom is the intuition? And Ramana Maharshi says, for one and all. And I think that's an important point too. Not about where the location of the heart is. but I think it's important to know that everybody has this intuition that will guide us back to the self. And in fact, Awakening Together is built on the fact that everybody has that intuition. And we don't need to rely on someone else to teach us. Whether you are contemplating a teaching, or whether you are closing your eyes and going into meditation, if you are doing this on your own, in my humble opinion, you're much better off than if you're trying to learn from a teacher, or if you're sitting in a group of people having an intellectual discussion about what something like a paragraph in A Course in Miracles means, or maybe even what Ramana Maharshi means by monad-like. If you are all by yourself with the desire to know what you don't know, which is the experience of truth, and you surrender to that desire and you trust that you can be led day by day, step by step, you will be. I always feel like I was lucky when I started the spiritual path. I started with A Course in Miracles, but I didn't even know there was such a thing as a course group. I was on the spiritual path for 5 years before I joined my first course group. And then I realized the course group was a pale reflection. It was like a Kleenex. It was a pale reflection of the rock-like wisdom that came when I sat down all by myself, not knowing anything, and just asked questions and received clarity. And that, of course, is because, you know, the course group was all up in the head thinking about it. They weren't down deep within where the wisdom really is. I think a lot of people believe, and therefore we do it this way, that we have to read books, and we have to listen to teachers, and in truth, we don't. That may lead some of us to the point where we finally go within alone. But the only thing we ever had to do was go within alone. You know, my very first teacher was Peace Pilgrim. And all I did, of course, was read her book. And she was very young. I mean, I think she was still in high school when she began to ask, what is God? And she said she would go and she would ask people, what is God? And she got varying answers, but she knew intuitively that none of those answers were correct, that really nobody knew what God was. And so then she started taking walks in the woods with her dog, just kind of mulling over within herself, what is the question, what is God? And she began to receive answers. Thank you for having come across that first, because I think that is probably what gave me the faith that I could learn from within. And in fact, not only did I have the faith, I had more than faith. I knew that if I learned it from within, and I didn't previously know it, but I asked and I learned from within, then it was true. If somebody outside of me told me, or I read it in a book, I didn't know it was true. I knew that, and I think I knew that because of her influence. So Ramana Maharshi, you know, says everyone, one and all, have this intuition. The devotee says, does Sri Bhagavan credit me with an intuitive knowledge of the heart? And Ramana says, no, not of the heart, but of the position of the heart in relation to your identity. But of the position of the heart in relation to your identity. I don't feel, if you want to trust my intuition right now, that this conversation that Ramana Maharshi is having with this devotee right now has any real meaning at all. Except that I do think that you have the intuition to know when you're listening to intuition. And we could liken that to knowing the position of the heart. I think that if you are sincere, you know when you're listening to your head, parroting what you learn somewhere else, and when you're genuinely learning from within. In fact, I talked about this morning in the gathering. I'll have to quit real quick. But in the gathering, I talked about how in that chapter 12 from NTI 1st or 2nd Corinthians, I don't remember, what I think it's 2nd Corinthians, how I got scared. And I quit genuinely listening within, and I started parroting the course. And the words all look fine, but I know that they didn't come from that genuine insight within. See, because I can feel that. And I believe you all can feel that too. You can feel if you're just parroting something you learned somewhere before, or if you're receiving genuine insight from within. So I guess I would just encourage you to feel that and feel for that genuine insight. It's much, much, much better to wait for the genuine insight than it is to parrot what you've heard. And with that, I'll let go of the mic. Thank you.